Side 2.
Some might say I was lucky to find the place first go. However, I would have found somewhere else sooner or later. I had the money. I had the will. Funny, what Crutchley called push. I didn't push at the annex, it didn't suit me. But I would like to see Crutchley organise what I organised last summer and carry it through. I'm not going to blow my own trumpet, but it was no small thing. I read in the paper the other day, saying of the day, what water is to the body, purpose is to the mind. That is very true, in my humble opinion. When Miranda became the purpose of my life, I should say I was at least as good as the next man, as it turned out. I had to give 500 more than they asked in the advert. Others were after it. Not everyone fleeced me. The surveyor, the builder, the decorators, the furniture people in Lewis, I got to furnish it. Well, I didn't care. Why should I? Money was no object. I got long letters from Aunt Annie, which I wrote back to, giving her figures half what I really paid. I got the electricians to run a power cable down to the cellar, and the plumbers, water and a sink. I made out I wanted to do carpentry and photography, and that would be my workroom. It wasn't a lie. There was carpentry to do, all right. And I was already taking some photographs I couldn't have developed in a shop. Nothing nasty. Just couples. At the end of August, the men moved out and I moved in. To begin with, it felt like a dream. But that soon wore off. I wasn't left alone as much as I expected. A man came and would do the garden. He'd always done it, and he got very nasty when I sent him away. Then the vicar from the village came and I had to be rude with him. I said I wanted to be left alone, I was non-conformist, I wanted nothing to do with the village, and he went off, la-di-da in a huff. Then there were several people with van shops and I had to put them off. I said I bought all my goods in Lewis. I had the telephone disconnected too. I soon got in the habit of locking the front gate. It was only a grill, but had a lock. Once or twice I saw tradesmen looking through, but people soon seemed to get the point. I was left alone, and could get on with my work. I worked for a month or more getting my plans ready. I was alone all the time. Not having any real friends was lucky. You couldn't call the annex people friends. I didn't miss them, they didn't miss me. I used to do odd jobs for Aunt Annie. Uncle Dick taught me. I wasn't bad at carpentering and so on, and I fitted out the room very nicely, though I say it myself. After I got it dried out, I put several layers of insulating felt and then a nice bright orange carpet, cheerful, fitting the walls, which were whitewashed. I got in a bed and a chest of drawers, table, armchair, etc. I fixed up a screen in one corner, and behind it a wash table and a camper's lavatory and all the etc's. It was like a separate little room, almost. I got other things, cases and a lot of art books and some novels to make it look homely, which it finally did. I didn't risk pictures. I knew she might have advanced taste. One problem, of course, was doors and noise. There was a good old oak frame in the door through to her room, but no door. So I had to make one to fit, and that was my hardest job. The first one I made didn't work, but the second one was better. Even a man couldn't have bust it down. Let alone a little thing like her. It was 2-inch, seasoned wood, with sheet metal on the inside so she couldn't get at the wood. It weighed a ton, and it was no joke getting it hung, but I did it. I fixed 10-inch bolts outside. Then I did something very clever. I made what looked like a bookcase, only for tools and things, out of some old wood, and fitted it with wooden latches in the doorway, so that if you gave a casual look, it just seemed that it was just an old recess fitted up with shelves. He lifted it out, and there was the door through. It also stopped any noise getting out. I also fitted a bolt on the inner side of the door, which had a lock too, down to the cellar, so I couldn't be disturbed. Also a burglar alarm. Only a simple one, for the night. What I did in the first cellar was I put in a small cooker and all the other facilities. I didn't know there wouldn't be snoopers, and it would look funny if I was always carrying trays of food up and down. But being at the back of the house, I didn't worry much, seeing there was only fields and woods. Two sides of the garden as a wall, anyhow, and the rest is hedge you can't see through. It was nearly ideal. I did think of having a stair run down from inside, but the expense was high, and I didn't want risk of suspicions. You can't trust workmen now. They want to know everything. All this time, I never thought it was serious. I know that must sound very strange, but it was so. I used to say, of course, I'll never do it, this is only pretending. And I wouldn't have pretended even like that if I hadn't had all the time and money I wanted. In my opinion, a lot of people who may seem happy now would do what I did, or similar things, if they had the money and the time. I mean, to give way to what they pretend now they shouldn't. Power corrupts, a teacher I had always said. And money is power. Another thing I did, I bought a lot of clothes for her at a store in London. What I did was, in one I saw an assistant just her size, and I gave the colours I always saw Miranda wear, and I got everything there they said a girl would need. I told a story about a girlfriend from the north who'd had all her luggage stolen, and I wanted it to be a surprise, etc. I don't think she believed me in the store, but it was a good sale. I paid out nearly £90 that morning. I could go on all night about the precautions. I used to go and sit in her room and work out what she could do to escape. I thought she might know about electricity. You never know with girls these days, so I always wore rubber heels. I never touched a switch without a good look first. I got a special incinerator to burn all our rubbish. I knew nothing of hers must ever leave the house. No laundry. There could always be something. Well, at last I went back up to London to the Cremorne Hotel. For several days I watched for her, but I didn't see her. It was a very anxious time, but I kept on. I didn't take the camera. I knew it was too risky. I was after bigger game than just a street shot. I went twice to the coffee bar. One day I spent nearly 2 hours there pretending to read a book, but she didn't come. I began to get wild ideas. Perhaps she died. Perhaps she wasn't doing art there anymore. Then, one day, I didn't want the van to get too familiar, as I was getting off the underground at Warren Street, I saw her. She was getting off a train coming from the north on the other platform. It was easy. I followed her out of the station and saw her go off towards the college. The next days, I watched the tube station. Perhaps she didn't always use the tube to go home. I didn't see her for 2 days. But then, the third day, I saw her cross the road and go into the station. That's how I found out where she came from. It was Hampstead. I did the same thing there. I waited for her to come out the next day, and she did. And I followed her about 10 minutes through a lot of little streets to where she lived. I walked on past the house she went into and found out the number, and then at the end of the road, the name of it. It was a good day's work. I booked out of the Cremorne 3 days before, and every night I moved into a new hotel and booked out the next morning so that I couldn't be traced. In the van I had the bed ready and the straps and scarves. I was going to use chloroform. I used it once in the killing bottle. A chap in public analysis let me have it. It doesn't go weak, but just to make sure, I decided to mix in a bit of carbon tetrachloride, what they call CTC, and you can buy anywhere. I drove round the Hampstead district and learned the A to Z of that part off and how to get quickly away down to Foster's. Everything was ready. So now I could watch, and when I saw the chance, do it. I was really peculiar those days, of everything, just like I've been doing it all my life. Like I'd been a secret agent or a detective. It finally, 10 days later, happened as it sometimes does with butterflies. I mean, you go to a place where you know you may see something rare and you don't, but the next time, not looking for it, you see it on a flower right in front of you, handed to you on a plate, as they say. This night, I was outside the tube as usual with the van up a side street. It had been a fine day, but close, and it came on to thunder and rain. I was standing in the doorway of a shop opposite the exit, and I saw her come up the steps just as it was teeming. I saw she had no raincoat, only a jumper. Soon she ran round the corner into the main part of the station. I crossed. There were a mass of people milling about. She was in a telephone box. Then she came out, and instead of going up the hill like she usually did, she went along another street. I followed her. I thought it was no good. I couldn't understand what she was doing. Then she suddenly shot up a side road, and there was a cinema, and she went in. I saw what it was. She'd rung up where she lived to say it was raining hard, and she was going in the cinema to wait for it to clear up. I knew it was my chance, unless someone came to meet her. When she'd gone in, I went and saw how long the programme lasted. It was 2 hours. I took a risk. Perhaps I wanted to give fate a chance to stop me. I went into a cafe and had my supper. Then I went to my van and parked where I could see the cinema. I didn't know what to expect. Perhaps she was meeting a friend. I mean, I felt I was swept on. Like down rapids. I might hit something. I might get through. She came out alone, exactly 2 hours later. It had stopped raining more or less, and it was almost dark. The sky overcast. I watched her go back the usual way up the hill. Then I drove off past her to a place I knew she must pass. It was where the road she lived in curved up away from another one. There was trees and bushes on one side, on the other a whopping big house in big grounds. I think it was empty. Higher up, there were the other houses, all big. The first part of her walk was in bright-lit streets. There was just this one place. I had a special plastic bag sewn in my Mac pocket, in which I put some of the chloroform and CTC and the pad, so it was soaked and fresh. I kept the flap down, so the smell kept in. Then in a second I could get it out when needed. Two old women with umbrellas, it began to spot with rain again, appeared and came up the road towards me. It was just what I didn't want. I knew she was due, and I nearly gave up then and there. But I bent right down. They passed, talking, 19 to the dozen. I don't think they even saw me, or the van. There were cars parked everywhere in that district. A minute passed. I got out and opened the back. It was all planned. And then she was near. She'd come up and ran without me seeing, only 20 yards away, walking quickly. If it had been a clear night, I don't know what I'd have done, but there was this wind in the trees, gusty. I could see there was no one behind her. Then she was right beside me, coming up the pavement. Funny, singing to herself. I said, "Excuse me, do you know anything about dogs?" She stopped, surprised. "Why?" she said. "It's awful, I've just run one over," I said. "It dashed out. I don't know what to do with it, it's not dead." I looked into the back, very worried. "Oh, the poor thing," she said. She came towards me to look in, just as I hoped. "There's no blood," I said, "but it can't move." Then she came round the end of the open back door, and I stood back as if to let her see. She bent forward to peer in. I flashed a look down the road. No one. And then I got her. She didn't make a sound. She seemed so surprised. I got the pad I'd been holding in my pocket right across her mouth and nose. I caught her to me. I could smell the fumes. She struggled like the dickens, but she wasn't strong, smaller even than I'd thought. She made a sort of gurgling. I looked down the road again. I was thinking, this is it. She'll fight, and I shall have to hurt her or run away. I was ready to bolt for it. And then suddenly she went limp. I was holding her up instead of holding her quiet. I got her half into the van, then I jerked open the other door, got in and pulled her after me, then shut the doors quietly too. I rolled and lifted her onto the bed. She was mine. I felt suddenly very excited. I knew I'd done it. I put the gag on first, then I strapped her down. No hurry, no panic, like I planned. Then I scrambled into the driving seat. It all took not a minute. I drove up the road, not fast, slow and quiet, and turned to a place I'd noticed on Hampstead Heath. Then I got into the back again and did a tying up properly, with the scarves and everything, so that she wouldn't be hurt, and so she couldn't scream or bang the sides or anything. She was still unconscious, but she was breathing. I could hear her, as if she had catarrh, so I knew she was all right. Near Redhill, I drove off the main road as planned, and up a lonely side road, and then got in the back to look at her. I laid a torch where it gave a bit of light, and I could see. She was awake. Her eyes seemed very big. They didn't seem frightened. They seemed proud, almost. As if she'd decided not to be frightened, not at any price. I said, "Don't be alarmed. I'm not going to hurt you." She remained staring at me. It was embarrassing. I didn't know what to say. I said, "Are you all right? Do you want anything?" But it sounded silly. I really meant, did she want to go outside? She began to shake her head. I could see she meant the gag was hurting. I said, "We're miles in the country. It's no good screaming. If you do, I'll put the gag straight back. Do you understand?" She nodded. So I undid the scarf. Before I could do anything, she reached up as high as she could and sideways, and she was sick. It was horrible. I could smell the chloroform and the sick. She didn't say anything. She just groaned. I lost my head. I didn't know what to do. I suddenly felt we had to get home as quickly as possible, so I put the gag on again. She struggled. I heard her say under the cloth, "No, no." Oh, it was horrible, but I made myself do it because I knew it was for the best in the end. Then I got into the driving seat and on we went. We got here just after 10:30. I drove into the garage, went and looked about to make sure nothing had happened in my absence, not that I expect anything, but I didn't want to spoil the ship for the little bit of tar. I went down to her room. Everything was all right, not too stuffy because I'd left the door open. I slept in it one night before to see if there was enough air, and there was. There were all the things to make tea with and so on. It looked very snug and cosy. Well, at last the great moment was come. I went up to the garage and opened the back of the van. Like the rest of the operation, it went according to plan. I got the straps off her, made her sit up, her legs and feet still bound, of course. She kicked about for a moment, and was obliged to say that if she did not keep quiet, I would have to resort to more of the chloro and CTC, which I showed, but that if she kept still, I wouldn't hurt her. That did the trick. I lifted her. She was not so heavy as I thought. I got her down quite easily. We did have a bit of a struggle at the door of her room, but there wasn't much she could do then. I laid her on the bed. It was done. Her face was white. Some of the sick had gone on her navy jumper and she was a real sight. But her eyes weren't afraid. It was funny. She just stared at me, waiting. I said, "This is your room. If you do what I say, you won't be hurt. Now, it's no good shouting. You can't be heard outside, and anyway, there's never anyone to hear. Now, I'm going to leave you now. There's some biscuits and sandwiches. I bought some in Hampstead. And if you want to make tea or cocoa." "I'll come back tomorrow morning," I said. I could see she wanted me to take the gag off, but I wouldn't do it. What I did was I undid her arms and then immediately went back out. She struggled to get the gag off, but I got the door closed first and the bolts in. I heard her cry, "Come back!" Then again, but not loud. Then she tried the door, but not very hard. Then she began to bang on the door with something hard. I think it was the hairbrush. It didn't sound much. Anyhow, I put the false shelf in and knew you wouldn't hear anything outside. I stayed an hour in the outer cellar just in case. It wasn't necessary. There was nothing in her room she could have broken the door down with, even if she had the strength. I bought all plastic cups and saucers, an aluminium teapot and cutlery, etc. Eventually I went up and went to bed. She was my guest at last, and that was all I cared about. I lay awake a long time, thinking about things. I felt a bit unsure the van would be traced, but there were hundreds of vans like that, and the only people I really worried about were those two women who passed. Well, I lay there, thinking of her below, lying awake too. I had nice dreams. Dreams where I went down and comforted her. I was excited. Perhaps I went a bit far on what I gave myself to dream, but I wasn't really worried. I knew my love was worthy of her. Then I went to sleep. After, she was always telling me what a bad thing I did, and how I ought to try and realise it more. I can only say that evening I was very happy, as I said above. And it was more like I'd done something very daring, like climbing Everest, or doing something in enemy territory. My feelings were very happy because my intentions were of the best. It was what she never understood. To sum up, that night was the best thing I ever did in my life, bar winning the pools in the first place. It was like catching the Mazarine Blue again, or a Queen of Spain Fritillary. I mean, it was like something you only do once in a lifetime, and even then, often not. Something you dream about, more than you ever expect to see come true, in fact. I didn't need the alarm. I was up before. I went down, locking the cellar door behind me. I'd planned everything. I knocked on her door and shouted, "Please get up," and waited 10 minutes and then drew the bolts and went in. I had her bag with me, which I'd searched, of course. There was nothing she could use except a nail file and a razor blade cutter, which I removed. The light was on. She was standing by the armchair. She'd got all her clothes on and she stared at me again. No sign of fear. Bold as brass she was. It's funny, she didn't look quite like I'd always remembered her. Of course, I'd never seen her so close before. I said, I hope you slept well. Where is this? Who are you? Why have you brought me here? She said it very coldly, not at all violent. I can't tell you. She said, I demand to be released at once. This is monstrous. We just stood staring at each other. Get out of the way, I'm going to leave. And she came straight towards me, towards the door, but I didn't budge. I thought for a minute she was going to attack me, but she must have seen it was silly. I was determined. She couldn't have won. She stopped right up close to me and said, Get out of the way. I said, You can't go yet. Please don't oblige me to use force again. She gave me a fierce, cold look, then she turned away. I don't know who you think I am. If you think I'm somebody rich's daughter and you're going to get a huge ransom, you've got a shock coming. I know who you are, I said. It's not money. I didn't know what to say. I was so excited. Her there at last in the flesh. So nervous. I wanted to look at her face and her lovely hair. All of her. All small and pretty, but I couldn't. She stared so at me. There was a funny pause. Suddenly she said accusing-like, And don't I know who you are? I began to go red. I couldn't help it. I never planned for that. I never thought she would know me. She said slowly, Town Hall Annex. I said, I don't know what you mean. You've got a moustache, she said. I still don't know how she knew. She saw me a few times in the town, I suppose. Perhaps she saw me out of the windows of their house sometimes. I hadn't thought of that. My mind was all in a whirl. She said, Your photo was in the paper. I've always hated to be found out. I don't know why. I've always tried to explain. I mean, invent stories to explain. Suddenly, I saw a way out. I said, I'm only obeying orders. Orders? She said. Whose orders? I can't tell you. She would keep staring at me, keeping her distance too. I suppose she thought I would attack her. Whose orders? She said again. I tried to think of someone. I don't know why. The only name I could think of she might know was Mr. Singleton. He was the manager of the Barclays. I knew her father banked there. I saw him several times in there when I was, and talking with Mr. Singleton. Mr. Singleton's orders, I said. She looked really amazed. So I went on quick. I'm not meant to tell you, I said. He'd kill me if he knew. Mr. Singleton? She said as if she wasn't hearing properly. He's not what you think, I said. Suddenly she sat down on the arm of the armchair, like it was all too much for her. You mean, Mr. Singleton ordered you to kidnap me? I nodded. But I know his daughter. He's... Oh, it's mad, she said. Do you remember the girl in Penhurst Road? What girl in Penhurst Road? The one that disappeared 3 years ago. It was something I invented. My mind was really quick that morning, so I thought. I was probably away at school. What happened to her? I don't know, except he did it. Did what? I don't know. I don't know what happened to her, but he did it, whatever it was. She's never been heard of since. Suddenly, she said, Have you got a cigarette? I was all awkward. I got a packet out of my pocket and my lighter and went and passed them to her. I didn't know if I ought to light a cigarette, but it seemed silly. I said, You haven't eaten anything. She held the cigarette very ladylike between her fingers. She cleaned the jumper up. The air was stuffy. She took no notice. It was funny. I knew she knew I was lying. You're telling me that Mr. Singleton is a sex maniac, and he kidnaps girls and you help him? I said, I have to. I stole some money from the bank. I'd go to prison if they found out. He holds it over me, you see. All the time she was staring at me. She had great big clear eyes, very curious, always wanting to find out. Not snoopy, of course. You won a lot of money, didn't you? I knew what I said was confused. I felt all hot and bothered. Why didn't you pay back the money then? What was it? £70,000? You didn't steal all that. Or perhaps you just help him for the fun of it. There's other things I can't tell you. I'm in his power. She stood up with her hands in her skirt pockets. She stared at herself in the mirror. Metal, of course, not glass. For a change. What's he going to do to me?
I don't know.
Where is he now?
Oh, he'll be coming, I expect.
She said nothing for a minute. Then she suddenly looked as if she thought of something nasty. What I said might be true, sort of thing.
Of course.
This must be his house in Suffolk.
Yes, I said, thinking I was clever.
He hasn't got a house in Suffolk, she said, all cold.
You don't know,
I said, but it sounded feeble. She was going to speak, but I felt I had to stop her questions. I didn't know she was so sharp. Not like normal people.
I came to ask you what you'd like for breakfast. There's cereal, eggs, etc.
I don't want any breakfast, she said.
This horrid little room.
And that anaesthetic.
What was it?
I didn't know it would make you sick.
Really?
Mr. Singleton should have told you.
You could see she didn't believe it about him. He was being sarcastic.
I said in a hurry, would you like tea or coffee? And she said, coffee if you drink some first. So with that I left her and went out to the outer cellar. Just before I shut the door, she said, you've forgotten your lighter.
I've got another.
I hadn't.
Thank you, she said.
It was funny. She almost smiled. I made the Nescafe, and I took it in, and she watched me drink some, and then she drank some. All the time she asked questions. No, all the time I felt she might ask a question. She'd come out quickly with a question to try and catch me. About how long she had to stay, why I was being so kind to her. I made up answers, but I knew they sounded feeble. It wasn't easy to invent quickly with her. In the end, I said I was going into the shops, and she was to tell me what she wanted. I said I'd buy anything she wanted.
Anything? She said.
In reason, I said.
Mr. Singleton told you to?
No, this is from me.
I just want to be set free, she said.
I couldn't get her to say anything more. It was horrible.
She suddenly wouldn't speak,
so I had to leave her.
End of side 2.